Good morning. My name is Karen Hardy. I'm running for the state senate in the 7th legislative district. And I'm running because I think democracy requires a choice.
Tell me where we're sitting right now.
We are sitting on my lovely front porch. I am blessed enough to live in Valley, Washington, on Jump Off Joe Lake, in the original homestead house. So, 1905 farmhouse with a red barn and a beautiful view.
And the nice wood plank floors in there.
Yes, it
Yeah.
is. It's exactly what everyone thinks they want, and then they realize when they get it, it's just a continuous update.
So we talked with you last year at Green Bluff, and you had your horses out, and it was one of the fall festivals or summer festivals, whatever it was. What have you learned since then? You ran against Shelley Short, you lost last year. What have you learned since then?
I've learned that people need to be inspired. And it's what I thought going into it, but it has been a continually learning and humbling experience that people had given up. People had become accepting of the status quo, and they needed someone, something to inspire them that they could be the change they wanted to see. It's not about voting for me as much as it is getting people out and getting them engaged. We have more people on city councils and school boards and fire boards this year because they were like, well, gosh, if she can run for Senate, I can sit on the school board. And so it's been wonderful to see. It's been a great learning experience that sometimes it just takes one person to open the door and then everybody starts to go through.
So all last year, I think they were all contested last year. You and Sue Swanson ran for the House.
Right, it was a special election, so it was the Senate and the House position won. So Jacqueline May Cumber and Susan Swanson. This year, it's all three positions. So Joel Kretz has three opponents, and Jacqueline May Cumber has Randy Michaelis, the dean at Whitworth, is running against her, and then I'm still running against Shelley.
And how do you feel about your collective chances this year as Democrats running in such Republican territory?
Well, I'm gonna just dispel that myth that it's not such Republican territory. 28 years it's been led by Republicans. That's who's been elected because that was who was running. Democrats stopped running. And so, from what I see in the county and what I know, we have about the same mix of party preference as you would find in Spokane. We just didn't have the same mix of candidates. So this year, with a full ballot, and fabulous candidates. We have CPAs and educators and citizen activists that I have to believe one of us is going to break through, if not all three of us.
And what is all the outside hoo-ha in the other part of Washington, the other Washington, and in the state of Washington? What does that do to rally those folks to go to the polls, do you think?
Well, I have spent a little bit more time in Western Washington this year, explaining to people that rural issues matter. That it's not just Washington State this has happened, and this is a national trend. That when you look at the electoral map, there's a big red swath in the middle, because we stopped addressing issues of rural and low density population, and that those issues do affect them. And if they want clean air and clean water and a quality life, then they have to address the issues of rural communities. So I've trying to break down the East versus West, us versus them, and trying to build those bridges that come on over, guys. We're your backyard, quite literally. We're where you want to come and play and recreate, and so you need to take care of it. You know, we need a little attention, a little fertilizer every now and then, you know, help us out, and we're going to be here for you.
And are there issues that the legislature took up that you think are positive that people are paying attention to those rural areas?
Well, I think this year we cleaned out a whole list of things that had been sitting on a shelf. And the Voter Bill of Rights, Women's Health Care Bill of Rights, children, making sure education was funded, and not just minimally funded, but properly funded. So all of those things affect these rural communities. But we still have a long way to go. We have a better forestry plan, but we're still working on forestry. Forest fires are always a big issue. This coal-fired smelter over in Newport is something that has brought a lot of attention from east to west, and we're still working really hard on finding out, you know, if that suits that area or not. I don't really think it does, but I honestly don't think they could have picked a worse place if they had have gone out of their way. It's a green field, pristine. It's been logged. The only thing that's ever happened to that in all of time in memoriam, above the Pend'Oreille River, which people forget flows north, goes into Canada and comes back into the Columbia River. And this plant will be burning coal, which people seem to miss the fact that in order to smelt silica, you have to burn coal. So there's going to be ash, there's going to be, greenhouse gases, all above a river in a tourist type town. It just doesn't fit. I understand we need industry and we need these products. Although now there's a glut of silica on the market. REC in Moses Lake is closing, and the tariffs from China there is no market for this product. So I'm hoping cooler minds will prevail and we'll find a better location for this project.
So what are your thoughts about how that debate has affected that community, Newport, and North Idaho for that matter?
It's, you know, I always look for the silver lining. It has brought so many people together. I've been over there for their events and their marches, and you have lifelong Republicans standing shoulder to shoulder with lifelong hippies. You have moderates on both sides, and just people who are not political, all rallied around one issue. And in that regard, it's been very good for the town. Of course, there's going to be some division, but for the most part, it has brought people together. It's got people talking. They have more people running for office this year than they ever have. People have begin to understand that political processes don't happen by little magic elves. Actually, good citizens have to go to meetings, they have to attend. And so, you know, in that regard, it's all been good. The downside is people are afraid, and I don't like to see that. And these are predominantly retired. I think the average age in Pend'Oreille County is 55. So these are people that have retired, had their life, and are looking for a simpler way. And this has definitely disrupted that. And again, I think there's a better path that where cooler heads can prevail and good decisions can be made. And we can get the products we need without disrupting the lives of these people.
So you mentioned McCleary earlier, or at least you talked about public schools. How do you think that the McCleary fix, the property tax increase that's going into effect, is going to help or hurt the rural schools in your district?
Well, there's a lot of, the McCleary fix is probably a wrong word, honestly. The property tax increase from last year, most of that was repealed this year. We did a $400 million property tax rollback. Because really we didn't need to raise people's property taxes to fund McCleary. That was a short-sighted move on the Senate Republicans. But having to be told by the Supreme Court to fund education to the minimum. I don't know about you, but my kids are worth more than the minimum. You know, I never bought the base package for my children. You know, we always tried to do the best we could for our children. So it strikes me as a little odd and a little painful that as a state, we are having to be told by the court to do the bare minimum. We have 650 tax loopholes and incentives for corporations in our tax code. And yet every time the kids need money, we raise people's property taxes. There's a better way. And by just closing some of those loopholes and just looking at the tax incentives we gave businesses who said, "Well, you give us this tax incentive, we'll produce 100 jobs or 500 jobs," and they haven't done it. Well, then give me my money back. I'm going to give it to the kids. There is a better way, and we need to continue to drive home the fact that education is constitutionally are paramount. That's what it says in our Constitution. It's not just a duty. It is our paramount duty to educate our children according to our Constitution. And that is an investment in our future, not a cost, not a debt. That is an investment. That is the way we ensure that Washington State will be successful in the years to come.
So I was talking with another candidate yesterday about, and she was for the state senate in the sixth, Jessa Lewis. Oh. She was talking about single-payer health care and that sort of thing. Yes. as a way to help, especially rural families who might not be able to qualify for some of the government. Would you go that far in terms of health care?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm working on trying to craft a proposal to have the 7th Legislative District be the test case for that. We have the lowest access to healthcare and the worst healthcare outcomes, statistically speaking, in the 7th. We sweep the podium in the top three or bottom three, depending on how you look at it, counties with Stevens County, Ferry County, and Ponderay County. We only have about 18% of the people who have private insurance in this district. So I think this is the perfect place to give it a go and do a single payer. Basically what we would do would just be allow everyone to be on Apple Care. So there would be no minimums for or maximums for income. And so if you live in the 7th, you live in these zip codes, that you have Apple Care, if you so choose. If you have something else you're happy with, great. But then what it does is it funds our hospitals, because what people miss in the healthcare thing is that for every time our uninsured rate goes up, our uncompensated care at hospitals goes up, and that's debts that they can't carry. So after the ACA, those debts started going down and down and down and got to a manageable level, and our hospitals in the 7th were doing good. In the last 2 years, with the changes that have been made, those unreimbursed debts have started going up in our hospitals again. We have 5 hospitals in the 7th that anchor our economies. They're not just for healthcare, they anchor our economy. So if one of those closes, what is already the poorest districts in the state will continue into this decline. So by providing everyone in the district with health care, so there is no unreimbursed medical for the hospitals, then we're protecting our hospitals, we're protecting our economy, we're ensuring people have good health care and access to it, and then they can do whatever they do to make money and not feel like they have to take a job that pays less because it has health care, and not have to pay a fine because they can't afford to pay for health care. It frees up people are creative in rural America, and it doesn't take a lot for them to live. But everybody needs to go to the doctor, and everybody needs to know they can. And just taking that weight off their shoulders and letting them know that you're good. We've got this part. You go out and be successful. I think this is the perfect place to give it a try and see if it works.
You have to get over the perception, though, that it's government-run healthcare.
It's not. It's government-paid for healthcare. The healthcare is still run by the same hospitals. It'll be Providence and Chewelah. It'll be Newport. It'll be Mount Carmel up in Colville. It'll be the Tenasket Hospital. Nothing. The hospitals won't change. The doctors won't change. But instead of United Healthcare or Aetna or Premera or Blue Cross Blue Shield paying, it will be paid out of basically what is now our Apple Care. So nothing will change as far as the consumers, other than by the hospitals and the doctors having a consistent income and knowing that they're going to get paid, they'll be able to increase their services. So we'll be able to have more clinics, we'll be able to have more doctors, because they know they're not going to have $2 million in unreimbursed care. That is what's preventing doctors from staying in business, clinics from only having PAs instead of doctors, because they never know what that unreimbursed care is going to be. Stability is the key to a good economy, and this will provide that stability.
So you're going on to the November ballot, whether or not however you do in August. But why is this August election important, do you think?
Well, it's our version of a poll. It's really tough to poll rural areas, and the polls are, as we all know, not very accurate. And so it gives us a good idea of where we are. When I started last year, a Democrat hadn't run in a decade. No one had been elected in 30 years. No one even thought it was possible. So after last year, we have a baseline. We know where we were. How are we doing now? Are we reaching more people? Are more people feeling engaged? Are more people voting? Where are we, and what do we need to do to continue that? This is a big ship to turn, and turning it in two election cycles it can be done, but it's going to be tough. So we need to know how much support is out there, and what do we need to do, and who do we need to reach? If did not run was a choice on the, or did not vote was a choice on the ballot last year, they would have won. So did not vote got 70% of the vote last year, or 60% of the vote
In the
last year.
primary or the general.
Both. Yeah. So we need did not vote to show up this year, so we know, you can't have a representative government if people, we don't know who we're representing and what they want.
So how do you convince folks the Democrats uphold the same values that Republicans do up here?
Well, I'm running as a Democrat, and I am a Democrat, but I'm running as your neighbor. And I uphold the same values because this is where I live. I live here for the very same reason you live here. I drive the same old 2003 flatbed Dodge that you see around town. And we all share that because we all made the same choice to be here or to stay here. Some of us were born here and never left. Some of us left and came back. Some of us, it's the first time, but we've all made that decision that this is where we want to be. And that's not a political decision. That's an emotional decision. And I have, the directions to my house have always involved the words, turn off the paved road. That's just who I am. And while we may not agree on how to get there, I find very, very few things that we disagree on. And as a rural person, I know my neighbors. Unlike someone who lives in the city who may not know the person who lives next door, I know every neighbor within probably a mile because I may need them. They may need me. We depend on each other. We don't have the luxury of some of the social safety nets that are in more densely populated areas. We are each other's social safety nets.
So the morning we talk is the morning after President Trump came back from Helsinki and the summit, and they're all the. How much do you talk about what happens in our federal government with folks, or do you try to stay away from that as much as possible?
We have to use it as a point of reference. To ignore what's going on now would be naive at best. What's happening now will be written about in history books, and we are living at a time that is changing. But like so many things, there's not much I can do about it. So I try to focus on what we can do and how we can affect change in our communities. And I firmly believe that all politics are local. But I am very concerned about our standing in the world. I've been so lucky to, I worked for an airline for 20 years. That was my career. And I've been all over the world. I've been to Helsinki. I've spent time in families and in homes. My daughter and I did a trip across Europe in 2013, and we stayed with European families every night. And I understand on that level how, back to that stability, how concerning it is for them that the US is not stable. And I think that's a things that a lot of Americans miss is that it's not just what's happening here, and it's not just the constant news cycle. It's that one thing that Europeans have taken for granted or have known for 40 years, that America is there, they're solid, and they will always step up to help us, is in question right now. And that creates a lot of tension in places that it doesn't need to be. I've had people for years envy that blue passport I carry with the eagle on it, because they say, when you carry that, you have the full force of the United States behind you. You guys will send the whole Marine Corps for one human being, no matter where they are on the planet. And I'm like, yeah, we pretty much will. Other countries don't have that. And when they see us losing that, it scares them. It's kind of like watching your parents get divorced. You know, it's just that instability that it creates that scares people. And that's not healthy.
Okay, Karen, anything I didn't ask you that you wanted to say?
You didn't ask about the dog. I'm just tired of not, not that dog, which dog? So I have a service dog who's not sitting out here with me at the moment, but I the little speckled one is my service dog. And I never talk about her because I never think about her because she's been with me for so long. But people don't want to ask because they think it's rude to ask. And I don't offer any explanation because, quite frankly, I don't think about it. But I had someone tell me the other day, you need to tell people why you have the dog. And I'm like, well, actually, I don't. That's an ADA thing. I don't actually need to tell people. But I think maybe that needs to be brought up, that it's... Because I have the opportunity to either educate people or annoy people. And I've chosen up to this point to annoy people, honestly. Because it's just... it's really none of their business. But I think maybe this is the time to educate people as to life with a dog.
So why do you have a service dog?
Why do I have a service dog? Well, I think the correct question is, I see you have a service dog.
I'm chastened. I see you have a service dog.
I do. I have had a service dog for several years now. Her name is Rio, and she goes with me most everywhere I go. And I had some medical conditions, and she can sense the changes in my body chemistry. So she's a medical alert dog, and she has very subtle alerts that just lets me know it's time for me to take some medication. And I take it and nothing happens. If I don't take it in about 15 minutes, then then I'm prone to having some medical issues. So most people just see her sleeping at my feet and wonder what is that dog doing. But on the rare occasion she jumps up and runs across the room, that's what she's doing. So
where do you take your service dog?
I take my service dog everywhere. I can't tell. I can't feel the changes in my body, so I don't know that I'm about to get dizzy and fall down, basically. But she can. And so I take her with me everywhere so that doesn't happen. As long as I pay attention to her, I haven't had any issues with, you know, being short on medication, except one time about a month ago. I was at a campaign event and I ignored her. And yeah, about 15 minutes later, the whole world starts to go kind of pear-shaped and you think you're going to pass out. And it's like, whoa, yep, she told me, didn't she? So that's what she does, and mostly she's a non-event.
So, and this is interesting you brought this up, because of all the bills I followed last year, the one I got the most response to was one about service dogs.
Yes.
And where service dogs should be allowed to be, and the fact that a lot of people misuse service dogs. How do you fall down on that?
Well, people don't misuse service dogs. People misuse dogs and say they're service dogs. she's not a pet in a vest. And it's really hard. I don't ever want anything to make it more difficult for people with disabilities to get the help they need or to just have access to everyday life. I take my service dog everywhere. I look like I'm a perfectly capable and healthy person, and I am a perfectly capable and healthy person. My body just doesn't regulate certain hormones. Nothing I can do about that, and there isn't a actual device to measure it. So there's not a medical, it's not like having diabetes where I can, you know, test. There's not a device to measure it, but she can smell it. So first off, there's some education to be done with people, that just because you see someone and you don't see something wrong, you can't identify what that dog is for, it doesn't mean it's not doing something. The second part is people who want to take their pets places and put vests on them make people like me life very difficult. That I understand you want to have your dog with you, and I understand your dog creates great comfort for you, and I get that. But my dog is keeping me from having a serious medical issue. If you can't say that, then it's probably not a service dog, and you need to leave them at home.
But some would say they're keeping me from having a mental health issue.
Well, and so, and health issue goes from psychiatry to podiatry. You know, it's head to toe. Our brains are in our bodies, and that is a health issue. And if that's keeping you from having a serious health issue, then that is a serious health issue. If it's just making you feel better, well, you know, that's a little bit different. But the issue that I run into most often in public is just lack of understanding that no matter what my dog is doing for me, no matter how important she is to my health, she is not allowed to be a disturbance. She is not allowed to be dirty. She is not allowed to make any sort of a mess. Now, unfortunately, or I could not say that about my own children. So my dog has to be better behaved than my children did. And if she's not, no matter if she's a service dog or not, people have a right to ask me to leave. You can't ask me to leave because you're allergic or you're afraid. But if my dog is causing an actual disturbance, then you can ask me to leave no matter what. And I think people with pets and vests, as I call them, those dogs are not trained to deal with the stresses of being in public. And if they misbehave, they need to be asked to leave. And if someone says, well, that's a service dog, still misbehaving, it still needs to be asked to leave. And that simplifies things. And but you can't accost someone just because they have a dog. When I walk in and my dog and I are both well-behaved, we're quiet, we're clean, and we're not messing with anything, really, that's just your cue to just let us go. And so it's curiosity gets the best of most people, and I get a lot of the, well, what's wrong with you? Well, there's nothing wrong with me. and I try not to say what's wrong with you. You have no manners. But it's about allowing people to have access to their lives. Without my dog, I have to have another human being. I my husband's with me. My children are with me. Someone is with me if I don't have my dog. If I have my dog, I'm able to go by myself. That's a huge change in my life, to be able to be completely free and independent just because I have a dog beside me. When you start questioning people with service dogs, sometimes you don't realize that you're questioning their independence. So tread lightly and politely. And if they're making noise or causing a trouble, ask them to leave.